With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agricultural news with me today. A study says farmers who increased online sales were more resilient during the pandemic. Farmers who increased the use of online sales and marketing were more resilient to the economic shock of the pandemic. That's according to a new study by researchers at the University of California, Davis. According to the study, published in the Journal of Agricultural Systems, farmers with a greater diversity of crops and livestock were better able to respond to the pandemic and reported no change or an increase in profitability compared to farmers with less diverse offerings. Some 46% of 364 California farmers and ranchers interviewed said they relied on online sales. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into our show headlines. In today's Ag News, from AgNet West, big headlines in animal activism that farmers should be aware of. Hannah Thompson-Weeman of Animal Ag Alliance says a recent court decision has given animal activist groups hopes for their movement.
We've also really closely followed some trials, which have involved a group who is known for what they call, quote unquote, open rescue. We would call it theft. That's when they break into a farm or facility and actually take animals. They claim that they're rescuing them and they need urgent medical attention. And that group has actually finally faced trials in a few of those incidents. One was in North Carolina towards the end of last year, and that incident involved taking a baby goat several years ago, and the activist in that situation was found guilty. However, just a few weeks ago in Utah, there was a trial held stemming from the theft of pigs from a hog facility several years ago. And in that case, after a week-long trial, 8 or 10 hours of jury deliberations, they were actually found not guilty. So they were able to make this apparently compelling emotional argument to the jury that yes, they went in without permission, yes, they took these animals without permission, but they shouldn't be found guilty because they were trying to help and do the right thing. They're really heralding that as a big victory for their quote-unquote right to rescue movement, and we unfortunately think that's going to lead to more and more incidents on farms because they now believe that they have the law on their side, again, despite that not really being reality. So those are some of the big headlines in animal activism that farmers should be aware of.
And now here's Brian German with more agricultural news.
Fusarium appears to have been a pretty significant issue this year for celery producers in the Ventura area. Yara Regional Sales Manager Patricia Dingus said growers have been working on multiple strategies to try and mitigate the impacts of fusarium.
Some of the things that can help, you know, are there varieties that maybe are a little more resistant? Are you able to sometimes be in rotation with ground that maybe is not as burdened with fusarium? That's not always possible. I have talked to and noticed that there is one particular grower that is exploring, you know, more of a foliar fertility to see if that would help be able to maintain or at least hit some of their yield targets that they're looking towards. There are some practices of, can we, through the fertigation, put in anything that would reduce the burden of the fusarium on the celery? Is there anything that would help maybe the roots push through and be able to help the crop grow? Unfortunately, it's not going to be a quick fix, and it's not a one and done fix either. But I know that as, you know, we press in together, we hope to be able to optimize whatever it is that we're doing to be able to increase the yield as much as possible per acre, even in light of having fusarium in the field.
A three-part workshop series on organic production is set to kick off on November 29th. The Practical Training on Nitrogen Planning and Management in Organic Production of Annual Crops online workshop series will take place in three parts and is designed for growers, CCAs, PCAs, and other agricultural professionals. Part 1 on November 29th will provide information on nitrogen and the role of microbes and the relevance of soil organic matter. Part 2 will take place on December 5th and will feature presentations on estimating nitrogen release from organic amendments and contributions from cover crops. The final workshop in the series will cover complete nitrogen budgets, synchronizing nitrogen release with nitrogen demand, and using soil tests, and will take place on December 12th. Those interested in participating in the workshops will need to enroll in all three classes. Registration for the series can be found online at the UCANR blogs page. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Today's show is sponsored by the makers of All Grow Compost. It's the perfect amendment for improving your soil's water-holding capacity. You can contact your soil health specialist, Tom Fantozzi, at 209-312-4016. Synagro, your partner for a cleaner, greener world. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, people shopping for electric vehicles will see that most don't have AM radio, and it's a move not sitting well with rural farm broadcasters. Nathan Symington is a commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission who spoke with broadcasters at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting's annual convention. He brought a unique perspective to the topic after growing up on a farm in Canada. He says AM radio is an indispensable source of information for more than 3 million farmers in the U.S. To those who say AM is a dead technology, 75% of farmers listen to the radio 5 days per week. For those who don't know, AM radio is also the essential spine of the emergency alert system. Symington added, more importantly, farm broadcasters, especially those on AM, are a trusted source of information. He said, forget about oil and gas. These days, trust is the most important commodity out there. And while at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting annual convention, I was able to get details on the latest developments from Nutrien. I talked with Frank Groves, the North American crop lead for cotton, rice, and specialty crops with Nutrien.
Oh, there's a plethora of things that are new. You know, we're in the process right now. You know, growers have just finished harvest and taking a look at what worked for them and what didn't work for them. We're in the process of evaluating all of our research plots. And, you know, seeing what we may need to add to our portfolio to give a grower an even better experience. You know, I would say the three biggest things that we have going on the crops that I oversee, we have a rice variety that's been out for 2 years now that's been extremely successful. And it's a variety that's getting hybrid type yield at a much lower seeding rate than a typical variety. On the cotton side of things, we have an extra long staple cotton that has fiber quality kind of in the neighborhood of a Pima, but it's an upland. So there's traits associated with it that aren't available in a Pima. So that's given our growers out in West Texas, Arizona kind of area an option they haven't had before. And it's still early, but it's coming down the pipe, I guess. We're still probably a couple of years out, but we're currently evaluating peanuts. And so we're going to be in the peanut game in a couple of years.
What are you looking at for peanuts?
Well, you know, we're looking at a couple of products that are really, at least from the data we've looked at early on, that are really a step change above what's currently out there from a yield standpoint, as well as a higher quality. So, you know, we're really excited about it, and we haven't really communicated that broadly to this point, but we're far enough along in it now that we're starting to feel pretty confident that we'll have something here in the next couple of years.
All right, anything else that we should know about?
You know, I would just say from a Nutrien standpoint, not necessarily seed specific, you know, but from a Nutrien Ag solution standpoint, you know, seed's just one component of what we're offering. You know, we have crop protection, we have fertility, we're in a digital space, we have a sustainability program that's very innovative and really differentiates us from anyone else. And just the number of retail locations and the local involvement that we have, I guess. So anyway, we're excited to help out any way that we can. If you just visit one of our retail stores, then one of our consultants can certainly guide you in the right direction to find a solution for your acre.
That again from the National Association of Farm Broadcasting annual convention, Frank Groves, the North American crop lead for cotton, rice, and specialty crops with Nutrien. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, we told you earlier this week that USDA's November cattle on feed report shows the number of cattle and calves on feed for the slaughter market in the U.S. was 11.7 million head on November 1st. That's 2% below November 1 of last year. As the numbers continue to drop, some are wondering how long the current decline in beef cattle numbers will continue. Well, Gary Crawford has a story with more details.
For the last few months, all signs in the beef cattle industry have been pointing to a downturn in the cattle cycle as producers have been selling more cattle than normal earlier than normal, reducing cattle supplies and beef production prospects into 2023.
My question is how do we look at that for a continued decline longer run?
Or are there signs of maybe a turnaround in the cycle? If so, when? USDA chief economist Seth Meyer is certainly looking for any clues on that. He told us that right now,
we continue to have poor forage conditions in the West, high feed costs. So I'm continuing to watch cow slaughter, continuing to even look at anecdotal price information for heifers. Just looking there to say, when are we going to maybe turn this?
Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. But the new USDA report did note placements in feedlots during October at 2.11 million head was 6% below last year. That's the lowest placement number for October since the series began back in 1996. Now, the National Milk Producers Federation sent a letter to lawmakers asking for support of domestic infant formula production as the shortfalls at emptied store shelves of formula have eased. Given the improving situation, tariff waivers that could discourage the production of a safe, secure domestic infant formula supply should be allowed to expire at the end of this year's schedule. The milk producer sent the letter to the chairman and ranking members of the Senate Finance Committee and the House Ways and Means Committee. Given the temporary shortfall that gripped American families in need of formula earlier this year has abated, we encourage Congress to ensure that the unique unilateral tariff benefits granted to our trading partners under the Formula Act and the Bulk Infant Formula to Retail Shelves Act end as scheduled at the close of the year, the letter said. It notes we request opposition to efforts to extend the benefits. And the National Milk Producers Federation and the International Dairy Foods Association say the USDA's proposed changes to the Women, Infants, and Children's Nutrition Program will limit dairy access. Unfortunately, the changes would decrease access to dairy products and the unique nutrient profile they provide, especially considering the current dietary guidelines say almost 90% of the U.S. population does not consume enough dairy to meet recommendations. The group say in a statement that nutrition science clearly shows that nutritious dairy products like milk, yogurt, cheese, and cottage cheese are especially important in the diets of women, infants, and children. They also say dairy is a source of 13 nutrients. That includes 3 of the 4 that are a public health concern, as noted by the dietary guidelines. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Farm employers' labor service compliance posters could save you thousands of dollars. Did you know that California lawmakers can be fined as much as $13,000 in government penalties if they don't have all the required employee and farm labor information posted for their workers? Avoid costly penalties and give yourself peace of mind knowing you are in full compliance with FELS posters. At only $175, this full set of laminated weatherproof posters eliminates the risk. Order yours at FELS.net.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
A proposed change to WIC could mean less dairy. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The National Milk Producers Federation and the International Dairy Foods Association say the USDA's proposed changes to the Women, Infants, and Children's Nutrition Program will limit dairy access. The group said in a statement, quote, "Unfortunately, the changes would decrease access to dairy products and the unique nutrient profile they provide, especially considering the current dietary guidelines say almost 90% of the U.S. population doesn't consume enough dairy to meet recommendations." They go on to say nutrition science clearly shows that nutritious dairy products like milk, yogurt, cheese, and cottage cheese are especially important in the diets of women, infants, and children. They also say dairy is a source of 13 nutrients, including 3 of the 4 that are a public health concern as noted by the dietary guidelines. The group say they look forward to working with USDA to modernize the WIC food package for eligible families to increase access to nutrient-dense milk, yogurt, and cheese. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. Sometimes farmers and ranchers must defend their livestock from harm caused by trespassing dogs. But there's a right way and a wrong way to do it.
Many states have adopted statutes that permit dogs to be killed if they're caught in the act of worrying, chasing, maiming, or damaging domestic animals. But every state law is unique, and it's critical to follow the specifics of the applicable state statute allowing the killing of trespassing dogs. If you don't, it could result in a criminal charge of cruelty to animals. Another point is that most state dog kill statutes are only designed to protect livestock-type animals. That means that they typically don't provide protection to persons shooting trespassing dogs in the act of harming wildlife, domestic pets, or even other family members. For example, in an Arkansas case, the statute provided no protection for a person who killed a dog while it was attacking a kitten. Because the law requires the dog to be shot while in the act of harming livestock in a way defined by state law, it's important to make sure you have evidence if you get challenged by an outraged dog owner. Photos and videos can be very helpful on this point in establishing that you acted within the law. When it comes to trespassing dogs, the shoot, shovel, and shut up approach may not be best. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen.
The 2022 Ag Sharks winner has been selected. Western Growers and S2G Ventures have announced the winner of the 2022 Ag Sharks Pitch Competition. Nut Jobs is a startup company that transforms nutshell waste into bio-benign plastic alternative products that are bio-based, compostable, and derived from secondary agricultural waste. By transforming nutshell waste into bio-benign plastics, NutJobs creates plastic substitutes that are cost-effective and environmentally sustainable. NutJobs innovation earned a record equity investment offer of $6 million from event judges. Paul Keffart, who's the founder and CEO of NutJobs, says, quote, "We're thrilled to win the AgSharks competition among such a strong group of finalists. It's an opportunity like these that not only helps companies spread the word about new ag-focused technology, but also supports our efforts to innovate further and scale our business. The network of growers, investors, and industry leaders at this event is incredible, and many of these conversations are just the beginning of partnerships that will make a long-term difference across the food supply chain." The other startup finalists who pitched their innovation in front of an audience of more than 300 producers were InSolution, which works in the ag tech sector to improve food safety through the development of novel methods for cleaning and sanitizing, and Swan Systems, to help water managers make the most out of every drop of water with data-driven decisions. To learn more, visit WGA.com. Many factors combining to make for a speedy harvest season. Why are most farmers finishing up harvesting operations sooner than normal? Well, USDA Gary Crawford talks with USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey to find out the answer.
The harvest season continues to speed ahead of normal, with many producers able to wrap up possibly before Thanksgiving. As we start the week, corn growers have 96% of that crop in the bin, sorghum 97%, both 6% ahead of average. Cotton harvesting 79% done and 8% ahead of normal, also ahead of average. Sunflowers and peanuts. We ask USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey why things are wrapping up so early.
The nation as a whole experienced its driest September since 1956 and its driest September-October couplet since 1987. So with that overarching autumn dryness, especially across the plains and the western Corn Belt, it was relatively easy for producers to harvest this year before the weather turned bad.
And in the drought areas, crops were ready sooner than normal for harvesting, and also actual planted acreage of many crops was smaller than last year.
Put that all together, and it turned out to be a pretty quick year for harvest.
Very quick. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. And reminding you guys of the 5th Annual Organic Growers Summit presented by the Organic Produce Network and Western Growers that's coming up November 30th through December 1st. This event will feature a variety of educational sessions, keynote addresses, as well as a sold-out trade show floor. Registration is happening now for that event. It's taking place at the Hyatt Regency Monterey Hotel and Spa in Monterey. Again, you can gather all of the information by visiting organicgrowersummit.com. Stay tuned. We'll have more Ag News after the break.
Hello, I'm Zach Ducheneau, Administrator for the USDA's Farm Service Agency. Voting is now open for the 2022 FSA County Committee elections, and that includes the urban county committees located in Albuquerque, Atlanta, Cleveland, Dallas, Minneapolis-St. Paul, New Orleans, Philadelphia, Phoenix, Portland, Richmond, and St. Louis. Now through December 5th, producers in eligible administrative areas can cast their votes for who will serve on their local FSA Urban Ag Committee. We're excited about these new committees, which are composed of local, urban, or suburban farmers who help us better support urban agriculture. Ballots for the 2022 elections were mailed to eligible voters the week of November 7th. If you did not receive your ballot by mail, you can request one from your local USDA service center. Ballots must be returned or postmarked no later than December 5th. For more information, visit fsa.usda.gov/elections or contact your local FSA office. Don't delay and vote today.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Farm Bureau just announced the keynote speaker for its 2023 convention in Puerto Rico, January 6th through 11th, 2023. Nikki Jones, Director of Events Marketing with IDEA Ag, says Bert Jacobs will deliver the keynote address.
The keynote speaker for the closing general session at the convention this year is Bert Jacobs, co-founder and chief executive optimist of his company called Life is Good. Bert and his brother John launched their business with $78 in their pockets, selling t-shirts in the streets of Boston. Today, Life is Good is a $150 million brand, and they are a positive lifestyle brand that impacts over a million kids a year.
Jones says Jacobs is a good fit for the agricultural audience.
Bert will tell us the story of how his brand came to be, all the mistakes, the missteps, and all of it. His story will leave farmers and ranchers with the tools needed to develop an optimistic mindset that eventually leads to success. He'll help farmers uncover kind of a deeper purpose in both business and life on the farm. It'll be truly, I think, an inspiring speech for them to hear.
You can register to attend the convention in person or virtually.
Obviously, you can be there with us in person in sunny Puerto Rico. We'd love to see everyone there. In addition to our keynote address, we'll have an incredible lineup of educational workshops, general session events, and of course, island exploration opportunities. You can also opt to join the action virtually. Just select virtual only registration. Go to annualconvention.fb.org to register.
Again, register online at annualconvention.fb.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
Urban agriculture is not new. People have been growing food close to where they live ever since people have decided to settle down and live in one location.
Leslie Glover of USDA's Office of Urban Agriculture and Innovative Production offers this example of urban agriculture.
The Pingree potato patches.
Named after the mayor of Detroit, who developed potato patches during an economic crisis in the mid-1890s, meant to feed unemployed citizens who tended to the sustenance gardens. Likewise, USDA has been involved in efforts going back to the war gardens of World War I and victory gardens of the Second World War.
All throughout the history of the U.S., there's been ups and downs with urban agriculture, and it's usually associated with hard times, and people recognize that there may be a need to go back and grow more food right where they live.
The increased recognition of urban agriculture and various advances such as hoop houses has led to not just sustenance growing, but economic opportunity for farmers in cities. That led to the development of USDA's Office of Urban Agriculture and Innovative Production through the 2018 Farm Bill. One aspect of this office is awarding various grants to promote urban ag.
Since the program has started in 2020, the USDA has invested over $40 million in 156 projects.
The most recent round of USDA Urban Agriculture and Innovative Production Grant Awards announced breaks down this way: 52 grants in total for pilot projects, over $14 million in investments in 27 states.
The grant program really has a wide variety of activities that can help in that vein. We have two types of projects. We either do planning projects or implementation projects.
The planning project grants
really help to initiate or expand efforts where urban and suburban farmers or gardeners, regular citizens, are really looking to target those food access issues to try to educate a new generation and connect them with agriculture, to help businesses that need some startup cost for new farming and for urban agroforestry in these areas, and then to help with zoning policies, because we know in some areas there may be difficulties with getting things like greenhouses. There may be problems with getting connected to the water source from a municipality and having to pay really high prices. So we're trying to really help these different producers to navigate some of these policies.
While with the implementation project grants,
this is usually when work is already started and we're really trying to help accelerate accelerate the work that the communities and organizations are already doing in some of these same areas.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Now is the time to get your herbicide plan ready for next year's crop. Failure to control weeds early, especially during a drought, can lead to serious issues in the field. Chris Barge is the Northern Plains Regional Sales Manager for UPL. Farmers don't want weeds taking up vital nutrients, so it's important to start quickly.
You got to start off right. So if you don't get the crop out of the ground and get your weeds under control, they're going to have issues day one. Put the drought to the side. Products like our Prepare, which you can mix with glyphosate products, as a pre-emerge or up till plant emergence, is a great product to help get some of your grass weeds under control. You can mix in some of our Otter brands, which will also help with the broadleaf side as pre-emerge. So I always tell my farmers, plan for success. And the first steps are getting those good pre-emergents down on the ground first and getting those weeds under control, because they're just going to rob moisture, fertilizer, etc.
While drought remains a concern for many growers, pre-emergent herbicides add a layer of protection to keep weed seeds from germinating.
What happens when we do get moisture? That moisture hits that seed, they're going to start to germinate. And you're going to have a wreck in your field. If you don't take care of the weeds up front early on, when we do have that moisture event, weeds will pop up across your entire field. And the problem is, it'll start robbing you of that moisture that you've been waiting for, and the nutrient intake as well, two of the key things that helps develop that crop. So pre-emerge is key.
Over the past 2 years, growers, and especially cereal crop farmers, have faced a lot of pressure from grasshoppers.
Because of the drought, we've had a tremendous grasshopper problem. Been really hot, really dry. In the last 2 years, grasshoppers have been just devastating the cereal crops. We have a product called Dimlin 2L that's great on grasshoppers. It's another product that you can use later on to help control some troublesome insects. It's hard to predict. We know the eggs are in the ground. It's all going to come down to, do we get those spring, early summer rains when we need them? And if so, it'll not only help with the grain feel, but also control the grasshoppers.
Don't hesitate to reach out to UPL or a company representative for additional support.
It's a true partnership, so don't be afraid to reach out to us if you feel like you need additional support or additional information that maybe you're, I won't say confused on, but just want to make sure you're using the right rate of a certain product on the field. Just know we're here and we're a partner with you.
For more information, go to UPL-LTD.com. Chad Smith reporting.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices. Today's show is sponsored by the makers of All Grow Compost. Don't settle for expensive fertilizer when you can get nitrogen and organic matter together, all at a great price. Contact your soil health specialist, Thomas Fontosi, at 209-312-4016. Synagro, your partner for a cleaner, greener world. Welcome back. Here's AgNet West, Brian German.
Welcome to another episode of the Making Sense of Biologicals campaign, a weekly series that will take a dive into various topics with unbiased experts in the field of biologicals. This episode is made possible by Marrone Bio Innovations, leading the movement to environmentally sustainable farming practices through the discovery, development, and sale of innovative biological products for crop protection, crop health, and crop nutrition. Marrone Bio's portfolio of 18 products helps a wide range of growers, from row crops and fruits and vegetables to tree nuts, vines, and greenhouse production, operate more sustainably while increasing their return on investment. For educational webinars and biological IPM programs, visit MarroneBio.com. Joining us today is Houston Wilson, Cooperative Extension Specialist with the Department of Entomology at UC Riverside. And now, Houston, you were a part of a multi-year project looking at biological control of grape leafhopper in vineyards evaluating the impacts of things like cover crops and hedgerows and things like that. And while some of those results weren't necessarily what you were looking for, you did notice something interesting as it relates to anagarous parasitoids. So talk to us a little bit about some of those results from the project.
What we know about these anagarous parasitoids is that they do rely on habitat outside of the vineyard. Certainly augmenting what's going on inside the vineyard is helpful, but their ecology is such that when they're in the vineyard over the summer period, reproducing on grape leafhopper, you have this break at the end of the season where the grape leafhopper, as the vines senesce, they overwinter in a reproductive diapause as adults down in the leaf litter and on perennial vegetation in and around kind of the perimeter of the vineyard. The anagarous parasitoids, in contrast, they need a leafhopper host that overwinters in an egg stage. And since grape leafhoppers in an adult stage, this forces the parasitoid to seek out an alternate host to successfully overwinter. And we know from some previous studies that they do utilize some other species of leafhopper that's found outside of the vineyard on natural habitat. So you may see reference from previous work looking at blackberry and French prunes and plants like this that were shown to harbor these parasitoids in the winter period. And so with that thought in mind, we went back and looked at the sites and actually quantified the amount of natural habitat around each site and used that as a variable in our analyses and found that indeed that was a very strong explanatory value. So that basically, sites that had more habitat around them tended to have higher populations of these parasitoids early in the season. And then that seemed to beget higher parasitism rates earlier in the season, which then led to lower late season leafhopper populations and really driving that biocontrol effect in this system. And so having observed that, we went and sampled all of the different plants that we could get our hands on in these natural habitats. So something like 70 different species or genera were sampled to identify which plants specifically were harboring these parasitoids. And, you know, over a two-year period, we sampled things all throughout that whole region every month and bringing it all back to the greenhouse and kind of teasing those parasitoids out of that vegetation. And what we found was, you know, confirmed, you know, that, yeah, there's French prune and blackberry. Those definitely harbor some fraction of the population. But what was really new and surprising to us was the role of coyote brush, which is a native plant, Baccharis pilularis, and it is really very dominant in many areas throughout the North Coast. It's very resilient, seems very drought tolerant, grows in all of these really disturbed habitats. And, you know, if you look at road cuts as you go up the 101 in Sonoma and things like that, you'll see, you know, Baccharis is kind of one of those first plants to colonize these areas. And it wasn't just that it was on that plant, but there was such a high number of parasitoids coming off of it per unit of vegetation, per like gram or, you know, meter of vegetation. So really an important plant that we hadn't been aware of previously. And that really clarified quite a bit to us what was going on, you know, regionally in the system. So, you know, whereas the earlier analysis showed that increased habitat diversity around a vineyard was really important, it really had to do with the presence of coyote brush. So, you know, further evaluating that data set, we saw that not only do the parasitoids utilize that coyote brush in the overwintering phase, but they actually seem to be on it. Some fraction of the population remains on it throughout the entirety of the season. So you have, you know, again, leafhoppers going dormant in the fall, the anagarous parasitoids exiting the vineyard, going on to coyote brush and blackberry and French prune. And then in the spring, when the vines become active again and the leafhoppers become active again, the parasitoids, a large proportion of them will move back into the vineyard and start reproducing on the grape leafhoppers again. But there seems to be some portion of the population that remains back on that habitat as well. And so, you know, the project, it kind of still had a good ending in a way, but it wasn't quite the ending we expected. So after all of this work, you know, we were able to, you know, learn a lot about the role of summer flowering cover crops, the potential contribution they can make to biological control in the system, and also identify some new habitat that plays a really critical role. So these projects, they don't always kind of go the way you think, but it's exactly why it's so important that we study them so closely, because, you know, I think while we all wanted to see these cover crops really have a great effect, like knowing that they weren't really doing much was, it's good. It helps us rule out stuff that we don't need to, you know, kind of spin our wheels around so much and really hone in on the things that are important, which in this case was the presence of coyote brush. So what we would like to do down the road is continue to explore that in terms of better understanding what is the amount and the spatial arrangement of coyote brush that you need in and around a vineyard to really guarantee like a reliable, consistent, positive effect on these anagarous parasitoids. And that's really something that I think down the road is going to be really important for us to further explore.
And in looking at that, in some of the areas that had more of the coyote brush, was there a higher level of parasitism for the leafhoppers? Was there, you know, a correlation between leafhopper populations and proximity of coyote brush?
So not so much. There's no relationship between grape leafhoppers and coyote brush directly. It was more that where you had more coyote brush, you would have higher populations of these anagrus parasitoids in the vineyard earlier in the season. Now, if for whatever reason that vineyard had a higher population of leafhoppers, there's definitely a what we call a density-dependent response that we would observe, because the leafhoppers, they have, in the North Coast, something like 2 to 3 generations per year, whereas the anagrus parasitoids have closer to 10 to 12 generations per year. So they can very rapidly build up their numbers. And so if early in the season you have a small number of parasitoids that go into the vineyard, but you have a lot of leafhopper eggs, there's a lot more reproductive opportunities for them there. And so, you know, even more so if you've got a vineyard where you have a lot of anagrus parasitoids showing up early in the season and a lot of leafhoppers, you'll see these populations get really, really big really quickly. So, you know, what drives leafhopper populations in vineyards? You know, it's their ability, you know, whatever sort of population they build up over the course of the season. We see that actually as a pretty good predictor, you know, of what's going to happen the next year. But that's irregardless of, you know, the presence or absence of the habitat. But, you know, that habitat is going to drive whether or not that population you see in the next year is going to come under biological control by these anagrus parasitoids sooner rather than later. And it's very important to get that process started earlier so those parasitoids can build up their population and really drive those leafhopper populations down as we get further into the summer.
Stay tuned. We'll have more after the break.
Farm Employers Labor Service Compliance Posters could save you thousands of dollars. Did you know that California lawmakers can be fined as much as $13,000 in government penalties if they don't have all the required employee and farm labor information posted for their workers? Avoid costly penalties and give yourself peace of mind knowing you are in full compliance with FELS posters. At only $175, this full set of laminated weatherproof posters eliminates the risk. Order yours at FELS.net.
Welcome back. Here's more Making Sense of Biologicals.
So with these anagrus parasitoids, while they are effective in attacking grape leafhoppers in vineyards, they also need the support of other leafhopper species to maintain their viability and overall numbers. And that's where it sounds like this coyote brush might be of value as sort of a support for these other leafhoppers that aren't a problem for vineyards, but apparently are necessary for the life cycle of the parasitoids.
Yeah, and that's, you know, we, in that work, when we surveyed plants in the natural habitats, we did collect leafhoppers from all of the same plants that we were rearing parasitoids from. And with coyote brush, there were a number of different leafhopper species that we found residing on that plant. And, you know, in the publication we put out on it, we said, okay, well, here's the leafhoppers we found on coyote brush. And then we kind of went through a process of ruling in or ruling out, you know, is this one, you know, what do we know? Which one overwinters is an egg? Which one of these are more common in California? And just trying to get an idea of what specifically, which of those species specifically the anagrus parasitoids were making use of. And we still, there's work to do there to definitively demonstrate that. I think we came down on a kind of two different species out of the 4 or 5 that we found on there, but never really definitively, you know, determined all of that. But it's an important point to keep in mind, because I think for the sake of simplicity, we talk about, you know, coyote brush is an important thing for parasitoids or for these anagrus parasitoids in particular. But really, it's all about that alternate leafhopper that is on that coyote brush. And so if you have coyote brush, but you don't have the populations of the alternative leafhopper host, it actually won't serve you very well at all, because that's really what the anagrus parasitoid needs. And so there's, you know, probably something interesting there to look at one day in terms of, you know, what is driving the populations of these alternative leafhopper hosts on coyote brush, and are there ways that you can make sure to maintain those populations if you were to establish stands of coyote brush in and around the vineyard?
So it's kind of a supplemental or a point of support for the biological control and helping to attract or maintain those levels of parasitoids to keep those populations abundant enough to address grape leafhopper populations in vineyards.
Yeah, they're an alternative host, which is critical to the life cycle of the anagrus parasitoid. So, you know, in some, I guess, you know, seeing that there was some fraction of the population that resided on the cavity brush all season, I guess, you know, you could say that, the anagrus parasitoids could just use one singular host, and it's whatever that leafhopper is on cavity brush, and they could just persist on that plant year-round. But there seems, you know, if you think about even sites that have a ton of cavity brush, there's still way more vineyard adjacent. And if the parasitoid at some point, you know, they're building up their population on cavity brush, they're going to run out of host at some point. And there's, you know, all these mechanisms that parasitoids have to, you know, they attack these things, but they need to, they don't want to kill all of them because they need them to kind of reproduce still to have a host. And so there's ways in which they kind of distribute their, you know, their parasitism and stuff. And basically, you know, you can get what's called spillover from these stands of cavity brush into the vineyard, where you have tons of grapes, tons of grape leafhoppers, a lot of viable host. And so kind of naturally, the part of the population will move into the vineyard. And because there's such an availability of grape leafhoppers out there, they'll really grow their population. So, you know, I mentioned earlier that the ratio or the spatial arrangement of, you know, cavity brush to vineyard is something we definitely need to better understand. You know, we think in some cases you may actually have biocontrol in reverse happening, where if you have very little of that overwintering habitat and a ton of vineyard, those parasitoids will probably, you know, the small amount of parasitoids coming off the cavity brush would build up a pretty significant population out in the vineyard and then come back to that cavity brush at the end of the season and maybe overwhelm the population that's there to the point where they parasitize all of them. And it might kind of create a bad situation where the cavity brush is there, but you've actually eradicated that alternative host, that alternate leafhopper host on the cavity brush itself. These are just kind of, you know, I'm just kind of noodling here out loud, but these are kind of ideas we've all discussed internally and things we'd like to explore, you know, experimentally in the future.
Oh, very good. And again, this has been another installment of the Making Sense of Biologicals campaign, a series to help spread the understanding of the biological field with unbiased experts. And again, this episode was made possible by Marone Bio Innovations, a leader in biological solutions for crop protection, crop health, and crop nutrition. Learn about their 18 biological products and access free educational webinars and IPM programs at MaroneBio.com.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.